Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast on January 26th, 2017, 6 days into the Trump era. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. With me, as always, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hey, Abe.
Hi, John.
And Noah Rothman, our assistant online editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
So, gentlemen, I wrote a blog post yesterday that got a lot of attention about how everybody is driving everybody else crazy, and the 6 days of the Trump administration have featured a kind of level of hysteria and counter-hysteria, the likes of which I don't think I've ever seen in my political lifetime. Every word that comes out of the president's mouth, every tweet that comes out of the president's fingers leads liberals into a kind of state of hysterical, crazed despair, rage, fury, and a sense of apocalyptic horror. That, given the fact that there's, you know, four more years of this to go, makes you wonder how they can sustain this kind of energy without having a collective nervous breakdown. Simultaneously, on the right, there is a hunger in that strange, you know, push me, pull you way to defend Trump against his liberal critics, even though a lot of what his liberal critics are saying is he and Sean Spicer and Kellyanne Conway and others are, you know, are telling lies, fibs, untruths. They're advancing arguments that are, you know, that are simply not based in reality, and people are in danger of sort of losing their essential integrity and acting as though what is going on is normal. And so my question to both of you is, how can this calm down? We can't live at this pace, at this level of noise, at this level of hysteria. It's just impossible. Noah?
Well, I'm of the opinion that it's going to calm down on its own after a while, because as you say, I mean, what can't continue indefinitely won't. Eventually this will stop. And I came across a BuzzFeed report the other day. The headline was intriguing. I felt like snarking on the headline, but then I realized I probably should read the actual piece. And it was
why would you want to do that?
I figured it was prudent because it was the headline was, you know, the left is going after Elizabeth Warren. And I thought to myself, well, how on earth could you go after Elizabeth Warren? This is the person who has self-styled her entire career to appeal to the left wing of the left wing. And it had to do with the fact that she and others in the Democratic Party are failing to stop the Donald Trump's nominees, his political appointees, from being confirmed. And this kind of unrealistic demand – I mean, nobody said anything about the nuking of the filibuster, by the way. It's just unrealistic, you know, garment-rending apocalyptic fervor, and it sounded very familiar. I kind of remember a lot of this in 2009 from the Tea Party, from the right, about the
2011?
End of the country.
How about 2011?
The country was ending. This is the end of the country. And that sort of thing did peter out when the political pendulum began to swing back in the direction of the right. And I imagine that's where it's going to go for the left.
But, you know, you make an interesting point, because in 2011 and 2013, both conservative activists were saying things like, well, why aren't you overturning Obamacare? It's like, well, see, there's this thing called the presidency, and even if we did X, Y, and Z, Ted Cruz shut down the government in an effort to end Obamacare when there weren't 67 votes in the Senate to support a veto override. And Republicans didn't even have control of the Senate then. It was madness. I mean, he led the House to do it, really. And so you have this. It's like, do something, right? You know, and if you don't, you're a coward and you're a loser and you're a fraud. And, you know, maybe it's sort of fun to see the shoe on the other foot a little bit there. Because we were standing here
saying – because I remember how it ended.
No, but we were standing here saying in our own camp, you people are crazy. What are you doing? You don't shut down. You don't have the United States default on its debt. You know, in order to make a point, you don't sort of hold the line and shut the government down. Hold the line against what? Like, there's a, you know, live within the limits of reality. You have a liberal president. He can veto anything he wants to. He is not going to be you know, punished by his own voters for being a liberal, and so don't be nuts. And maybe now they're doing that to their own people.
My prediction is, if it gets better, it's going to get worse before it gets better, because Trump is taking the first 100 days thing seriously, and he's on a policy tear, and if the left is going to live every day as if we are in a perpetual state of emergency, I think the danger there is this self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, as the sort of troops come out for both sides, this could begin to escalate and really kind of conform to the kind of situation that they're describing.
I mean, the situation is this: Democrats didn't just lose the presidency; they failed to secure an overturn of the Republican majority in the Senate. That is where all of the difficulties for Democrats lie here. Had Democrats, managed to, sustain or, win three seats more, defeat Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, defeat Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania, and defeat Richard Burr in North Carolina, they could block every Trump nominee. The entire story of the last week, and indeed of the next year, would be something entirely different. This sort of "we will not let anything pass" thing could work very effectively in their favor. And since they idiotically eliminated the filibuster for executive branch appointments in 2013 because Harry Reid wanted to get judges through and some other things through, at least they would at the very least have forced Republicans to do it now to get their nominees through, and then they could have stood there and screamed about how, this was a naked power grab, and could have used it in the 2018 elections to say, Republicans were, forcing their will on people, which helped. I think the overturn of the filibuster in 2013 probably helped Republicans win those nine Senate seats in 2014 by saying the Democrats are they're just out of control. Someone's got to control them. Main claim that Democrats are going to be able to make in 2018 is that there needs to be divided government because there needs to be a check on Trump. That has been something that we've seen as voters take as a positive for a very long time. Hard to believe that it won't necessarily be a selling point for them now. So if they can just get it together and, not look like every single thing that happens, is the coming of the comet that is going to destroy the earth.
But you know why I think they can't? In part because it's this sort of this dual track breakdown where they find the actual policy things he's doing repugnant. They're against them, but they also consider him such a clown that they're this tension between sort of making fun of him as an idiot and as an actual malign force.
That's so familiar.
Has their heads exploding?
Well. So if I look at I have many friends, many liberal friends and many conservative friends on Facebook. And as I look at my Facebook feed, what I see is people saying, this is horrible. We must stop Betsy DeVos from becoming education secretary and, and putting these policies in place. Well, no, honey. That's what happens when you don't win the presidency. Obama gets his education secretary and gets to put in policies that we find repugnant. And we win, and then we get to put in an education secretary and put in policies that you find repugnant. That is normal. This is the normal order of things. There is a policy shift underway because there was a partisan shift in the electorate that led to Trump's victory, and the executive branch changes direction and changes policy. And this leads to the second point, which is hysteria over the announcement by Trump and the White House that it wished all communications from cabinet agencies to cease until they could figure out what was going on. And this is being treated as some kind of a horrible depredation, violation of free speech rights and everything. Every administration has done it. When you change on January 20th, there is a new sheriff in town and, the EPA doesn't get to be the Obama EPA during the Trump years, and the Commerce Department doesn't get to be the Bush Commerce Department in the Obama years, and we have a fantastic piece in the current commentarymagazine.com right there, Tevi Troy. The story of what happened when Tevi Troy, our redoubtable author, was part of a landing team at the Department of Labor when George W. Bush came into office, and how they sought to secure the fax machine to make sure that new regulations weren't promulgated by the Labor Department, sort of under the radar in the first couple of days of the new Bush administration, because it wasn't going to like Clinton era regulations and it didn't want them to be passed anymore.
So today, Twitter is the fax machine.
There you go. So you're securing the fax machine because, because some National Park Service guy in North Dakota started, tweeting out stuff hostile to the Trump administration's policies, and so they shut him down. As we were saying before, the National Park Service office in Deadland doesn't own the National Park Service Twitter feed. Ranger Rick out there wants to tweet about climate change and how he hates Trump. That's his business. The public owns that Twitter feed. It is not owned by that office. It is not secured by that office. It does not have a blue check mark because of that office. It is part of the federal government, and it cannot be hijacked by somebody.
I kind of built off your piece yesterday, which I recommend everybody read. What was the name of it? The Elites? The National Elite
Nervous Breakdown.
Nervous Breakdown. Go read that. Building off that, there were two media freakouts yesterday about Trump, which were, talking about how this is so unprecedented when it's actually very precedented. The tweet that he sent out, albeit very unpresidential, in which he complimented Fox News for its inaugural ratings, of which he's obsessed, and calling CNN fake news. It's not as though this hasn't happened before. We had an administration-wide policy trying to discredit Fox News, get them out of the briefing room, keep them away from Kenneth Feinberg.
Under the Obama administration.
Under Barack Obama. The chief of staff of the White House said Fox is not a news network. And I'm quoting him there. So they're kind of crudely mirroring the Obama administration. Secondly, the press office sent out some press clippings, some positive press clippings of this administration, again, indicative of their obsession with their media coverage. But this is not unprecedented either. A lot of people said that was like 1984, but the White House operated a blog under Josh Earnest, which was populated with headlines touting the benefits of the Iran deal. So these sort of unprecedented things are truly precedented. What's really possibly unprecedented is what you noted before, and I don't know if this is true or not, but I can't recall an effort by the opposition party to block and thwart and stall the confirmation processes for a new administration for high-level cabinet positions, up to and including the CIA director we're in the middle of a covert war. I mean, that's the sort of thing that Democrats would be rending garments over, and I don't believe that has happened, at least not in my lifetime. It's sort of a courtesy.
No. It doesn't happen unless there is a specific issue that has been raised in the process, in the vetting process.
Right. This is a blanket
where you need
issue.
Where you need hearings and you need a little time to prepare them. And often that time is spent with the administration getting to the point where it tells the nominee to go away, which is not going to happen in this case.
This was the logic that led to the nuking of the filibuster, by the way, opposition to the nominee and the president, not the nominee himself, just trying to thwart a nomination in order to harm and rob the president of political capital. That was the justification for nuking the filibuster.
Right. And of course, there's massive precedent for that too. So in the 19th century, which was not – it's not a time when you want to look at the best working order of the American government is the 19th century when, of course, the country ended up, breaking down into civil war. But nonetheless, what is unprecedented, and I think it's fair to say that it's unprecedented, is – generally speaking, presidents and their White Houses try to twist themselves into knots to provide authoritative information, even if it's spin. In other words, when something comes out of – I worked in a White House a long time ago, but I know this is true of White Houses. You issue a paper, you have a number, you use numbers, you do stuff like that. And you have fact checkers and you have double fact checkers and triple fact – because you don't want to be attacked for – for no reason, for purveying false information. Like that's an unforced error to do something like that. Presidents then often lie. They say if you want to keep, you can keep your doctor if you like your doctor. But that's not a fact. You know, it is ultimately a fact, but it's not a deliberate act of, you know, misrepresentation by the president. The fact that Sean Spicer and Trump and Kellyanne Conway are claiming against all, you know, reality that more people watched his inauguration than anybody else and that there were more people at the inauguration than anybody else is very disturbing, because it means we are being told from the very outset of this administration that we cannot trust the facts that it is promulgating. And that is new. I mean, even if you don't like Obama and you didn't like Bush and Bush lied about the WMD and stuff like that, if Bush said there were 12,622 nuclear warheads, if the press secretary said that, then you knew that number had been, you know, painstakingly fact-checked and that you could take that to the bank.
Yeah, and I also unprecedented, and I think it goes hand in hand with this, and it's equally as disturbing, is the fact that we have an American president who is focusing on these petty issues and whose weakness is is constituted by accusations of not being popular. This is the sort of personality cult that he feels about himself is a disturbing thing.
It's little things too. It's not just this immigration thing where there's like that millions of illegal voters we're going to be investigating at taxpayer expense, which we know the answer to that investigation already. It's also like Tiffany Trump's voter registration. Like you had some reports from Wall Street Journal and Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal Project Heat Street and Washington Post, both of which confirmed that Tiffany Trump was registered to vote in New York and New Jersey, which, you know, is a thing. It's not – you're not going to go to jail for it. Technically, you should send in a voter cancellation form when you're moving from one state to the other. Nobody does. And they got her on that. And then you had Kellyanne Conway saying, you know, this is not true. You know, you can't believe your reports. It's just not true. She didn't provide any evidence to support that. It's just, there you go. That's the fact on it. And it, just, you know, to spin this out, I mean, this is trivial stuff.
So what does it matter? Like, I'm probably still registered in Virginia. I haven't lived in Virginia in almost 20 years. I don't know that they've cleared the voter rolls. And I'm likely registered in Virginia. I mean, Steve Bannon apparently was registered in two states.
Florida.
Steve Mnuchin was registered in two states. That's, you know, that happens, and it's not a form of voter fraud. I mean, although theoretically it could be. But, so all Kellyanne Conway had to say is big deal. Like, they're, you know, big deal.
And but here's the
she's
thing
a college student. Like, we were alone.
But we rely on the executive branch for a lot of statistical information. And we had, for example, over the course of the campaign, Donald Trump fervently claimed, and he'll probably stick to this claim, that the Bureau of Labor Statistics was falsifying data, falsifying the unemployment rate in order to, you know, pluff up the Obama administration's claim to having a reduced unemployment rate. To my knowledge, he has not yet appointed a commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is a confirmable post. And now I'm pretty sure that should come up in the confirmation hearing, because if he's really genuinely believes that presidents manipulate data for their own political aims, and he's got a very tenuous relationship with the truth, why wouldn't they seek to manipulate this data?
Right.
They believe everybody does it.
Well, you remember in 2012, in September of 2012, there was a very good jobs report, and Jack Welch, the former head of GE, tweeted, you know, very suspicious that this number should be so good. And then the entire world came down on his head, and there were these reports about what actually happens at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They're in a room, and the room is in the basement, and there's glass, and the glass is covered by curtains, and no one is allowed to look in and look out, and this number is so protected, and, you know, And the rage and the was so disproportionate that it almost made me believe that Welch was on to something. You know, it's like, you know, it's like the famous, you know, Price Waterhouse. You know, no one will ever know who was actually won the Oscar. You know, because it'll never come out. No one will ever know. But yeah, I mean, if you believe that there is no such thing as truth, and that truth is simply, you know, the handmaiden to whatever it is that you need, or there's no such thing as facts, whatever the handmaiden to you need, yeah, you have a little bit of a problem. What if? And by the way, it works in the other way too. What if the unemployment numbers are really good? The unemployment numbers are really good. And then Democrats are going to start saying, I don't know. I mean, look at Trump. You know, he said 3 to 5 million illegals voted. And how do we know that he's not leaning on – his labor secretary isn't leaning on the Bureau of Labor Statistics to screw around with the numbers, you know?
But that wouldn't be an out-of-control accusation for them to make. They'd be relying on Donald Trump's own statements to make that assertion. Even if it is unfounded, this is a trap they set for themselves.
I'm agreeing with you.
And, you know, also if he goes on these pet witch hunts, you know, if he's going to start sort of backing up each assertion with some investigation, I think that's going to be bad too.
Well, look, the horrifying story was the one that came out last night that the main sort, the thing that he told Congress when they asked him why he was putting pressure on them to do an investigation of, you know, voter fraud was that the German golfer Bernhard Langer tried to line up in Sarasota to vote and was told that he was not a citizen, he would not be allowed to vote for his friend Donald Trump. But that Langer told Trump that he saw some people in line who looked like foreigners to him and they got to vote. And this is what he says to, you know, a meeting of Congress, like, you know, early times, like, this is not somebody who knows these congressmen. Like, they're going to go home and go, oh my God, like, oh my God, oh my God. Oh, like many of us do, you know, like I saw that last night and my blood ran cold. You know, I mean, Bernhard Langer is his source for the notion that there were 5 million. First of all,
foreign-looking people in South Florida.
Yeah. Also, he told David Muir last night on ABC that not a single one of the illegal votes cast in this election, of the millions of votes, could possibly have been cast for him. Therefore, they were only all cast for Hillary. This is why voter fraud, by the way, is much less of an issue. We've talked about this on earlier podcasts, but one of the reasons why people who, you know a lot about voting say you can't really imagine that voter fraud turns large scale elections is that you have to presume that the voter fraud that exists is on both sides so that it cancels itself out. If there are 10 million votes cast and there's somehow 50,000 dirty votes on the Democratic side, it is likely there will be 50,000 dirty votes in some fashion on the Republican side. And though you can't really isolate on them, you figure it basically all comes out in the wash. It's only when elections are, you know, 600-700 votes separating them that you start getting nervous when people say, oh, I just found 300 votes in my car trunk, which has happened.
Let's play amateur shrink for a second, because there's been a lot of talk about this online. Does he believe this? Or is he saying it because he wants to convince people of it?
I think it's like a Costanza syndrome. Like, you really do convince yourself of the lie. I think he's managed to convince himself of at least the necessity of the lie, if not the veracity of it.
But think about what he's done here. He threatened to say that the results of the election would not be valid if he lost. So because nothing that he says can be wrong, it can turn out in this bizarre fashion that what he said about the validity of the election was true even though he won. I mean, that would be the psychological effect. It's like he can't say, well, I guess I was wrong in October to say I shouldn't, you know, respect the legitimacy of the results. So now it's like, well, I shouldn't respect the legitimacy of the results because I didn't win the popular vote even though I won the Electoral College. So obviously that was dirty. So I was right. Even though I was wrong, I was actually right, or I wasn't wrong at all. I have another theory to lay out for you. This would be the Scott Adams of Dilbert, you know, neuro-linguistic programming theory, which is, so here's Trump. He's at 46% or 40% in popularity in the poll, you know, and he says this, I'm popular. More people watch my inauguration than anybody. More people watch my inauguration than anybody. More people watch my inauguration than anybody. And then, you know, if you keep saying it and keep saying it and keep saying it, for people who aren't like looking at crowd numbers and looking at this and looking at that, by the end of the year, half of America will think that he had the largest crowd of any inaugural because he just keeps saying it over and over and over again. So maybe this works for him. You know, it's like, I'm very successful. I'm very smart. I'm really smart. I went to Wharton. I'm so smart. I'm really smart. So we all go, oh my God, this is embarrassing. It's like nobody talks about how smart they are because they went to Wharton. And then people in the country are like, he's really smart. He went to Wharton. That was the whole point of this much discredited, much derided series of blog posts by Scott Adams, the author of Dilbert, explaining Trump's success with voters. And Virginia Hume wrote a really brilliant essay in the Weekly Standard that kind of echoed this point, that it's a seducer's – it's a seducer strategy. It's like, you know, go out with me. I'm really cool. It's really going to be fun. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's really going to be a lot – come on. Why don't you go out with me? Come on. We'll have really a lot of fun. We'll have a lot of fun. We'll have a lot of fun. And the woman says, no, 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 no. And then eventually he sort of breaks her and it's like, I'm really cool. I'm one of the best guys you'll ever meet. I'm fantastic. I'm amazing. I'm just amazing. I'm totally amazing.
You can see him do it in action. It's almost like the Jedi mind trick. I remember he was approached by a veteran early in the campaign who said, I want to support you, but I'm concerned about some of the things that you said about John McCain not being a hero. And there's footage of it. And you see Trump saying to him, you know what I was trying to do. And there's a little pause and the guy goes, I know what you were trying to do. You know what I was trying to do. And he sort of went on to the next. You know, and now he goes before the intelligence community and says, you know that there's no one admires you more than Trump, right, than Donald Trump. Yeah. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, even using himself in the third person is a sort of way of sort of hypnotic suggestion.
Yeah, so who knows in that case, you know, maybe it is more conscious than we realize, and that he has this idea that people spoke of Steve Jobs as being somebody who was able to create a reality warp around himself, that he would tell people before there was an iPod that they were going to invent this device that was going to be insanely great, and it was going to do this, and it was going to do that, it was going to do the other thing, and 10,000 other things, and such a device never existed, and probably, in fact, will never exist. You know, it'll take your heart, it'll cure cancer, it'll fly you to the moon, whatever. But hearing him and hearing him talk when you left the room, suddenly there was an iPad in front of you, and it was 5 years away from the iPad being built, and that this was one of his great strengths, that he could ignore and avoid present reality and lead people with this kind of hypnotic focus on that which was unseen. And maybe this reality distortion field, maybe this is part of what explains Trump. And if you're not susceptible to it, it just makes it worse and worse and worse and worse and more and more and more distressing and promotes this kind of hysteria. Give you another example of the hysteria. So another friend of mine on Facebook, very worried about the emoluments and, you know, Trump's refusal to release his tax return, said we should start a mass movement to encourage people at the IRS to leak Trump's tax returns because the public needs to know. So the only way the public is going to know is if they're leaked by somebody. And this is interesting because I'm sure a lot of people in his feed went, yeah, that'd be great. It's totally great. If that were to happen, that is the end of privacy in the United States. There are about two or three or four things that are sacrosanct in the United States. And the notion that the federal government, that employees of the federal government, would feel themselves in a position, if they did it with the President of the United States, to go muck about in people's most personal information and release it to the public because the public had a right to know. 10 years later, you'll have lawyers paying people off, you know, in divorce proceedings to get people's tax returns, or to do something if you're a bit, you know, and anything that happens, some leaker at the whistleblower at the IRS can go and leak their tax. Once you break a rule like that, civil society comes very close to an end. And that's what I mean by, that's where I really worry that norms are going to break down that aren't just Trump breaking down norms. It will be this, he's so awful, the ends justify the means. We have to get him out by any means possible. And the means that they advocate will, in fact, do much more damage to us than they will to him.
Yeah, that's the self-fulfilling prophecy concern I have, too. It's like if they're saying we live in this state of an emergency, well, you can hasten that. You can bring that on by exacerbating everything.
Right. I mean, this is the concern. This is why the Secret Service exists, right? Is that the notion that people get into the notion that the only way to save the country from an evil leader is assassination. And so you basically have to build this core of people who will take a bullet. And then, of course, there's that interesting story about the Secret Service agent in Denver who has already said that she would not take a bullet for Trump. And you really wonder, like, okay, fine, you don't want to take a bullet for Trump, then resign. What's the matter with you? Like, if that's your moral position, and I don't blame you, but you got to go find another line of work. could be a Secret Service agent saying that you're not, you know, you're not going to use your body to defend the president. That's what the job is, except for like finding counterfeiters or something. They have some other mission. I can't even remember what it is. It used to be counterfeiter. Yeah, still? Okay. So maybe she can go find counterfeiters. But I'm just saying, like, there's another violation of a norm. So now in a position where, you know, bad enough the Secret Service went through all these scandals during the Obama years of, you know, hiring prostitutes in Colombia and all that. We also now have the example of openly Secret Service agents saying that they are so distressed by their leader that they wouldn't save him if he were to be assassinated. Sole purpose of the existence of this elite corps of, you know, American defenders. So that's what I mean. Norms on both sides are in grave, you know, jeopardy. And that's one of the tests here, right, is will the institutional history of the Secret Service hold up, you know? Will the institutional history of the Treasury Department, the Internal Revenue Service hold up so that people will not be leaking people's tax returns?
But, I mean, the funny thing is that the threat to this system is not anything it comes from his style. It comes from his manner. It comes from his lack of decorum.
Right.
That's the outrage that's putting pressure on the system. He's not breaking laws overtly here.
Well, we were having a conversation. We were having a conversation about this whole thing about silencing the agencies, right? That we talked about 10 or 15 minutes ago, and we had an argument. Noah and I, in particular, had an argument about
so rare,
very rare about. Noah said, "This is terrible. I mean, it says that, you know, he's told Congress not to communicate. You know, he's told agencies not to communicate with Congress." And I said, well, if he's told agencies not to communicate with Congress, first of all, he can't do that. But you know, the whole point of that would be he can't communicate with, you know, Congress doesn't communicate with, you know, the Omaha office of the Department of Commerce. There's a whole intergovernmental system where cabinet departments have legislative affairs offices, and you go to them and they issue a request and they get the information, they bring it back. Because these are co-equal branches of government and they need to have mutual respect. And obviously Congress can subpoena people, but whatever. And then when we looked up the stories, it turned out that, A, it didn't actually say Congress. It only was talking about social media. But that in these stories, there were all these people saying, this effort to throttle social media could be very worrying in the future about the way the Trump administration will communicate. Could be, might be, will be, maybe. Could be, possibly be, could be silencing, could interfere with the public's right to know. No evidence that it will interfere with the public's right to know. What's going on is totally normal and something that every administration does. But this is where it goes to your question of his behavior. So you go, well, he doesn't respect any norms, and as we say, he lies and that sort of thing. But that there's no evidence yet that any of that is going to affect policy. You know, he is damaging his own future. The acceptance of his integrity in the future by lying so much, as Noah said. You know, how can you trust the Bureau of Labor Statistics if he's willing to tell self-evident lies about crowd size? But saying he could do terrible things, that was already litigated in the election. That's what we all said.
Yeah, I think the confusion stems from, and I'm just reading about this now, is that the order is to direct public officials to cease their communications with members of Congress and state and local officials. So it's not as though a committee or a subcommittee requests something from an executive agency and they won't get that report. It's that X member of Y agency is not at liberty to discuss with this congressional office their personal grievance.
Yeah, because very, very simply, right now there are no political appointees in the Trump administration anywhere in the federal government. And so what you have there are people who are ideologically out of sync, ideologically and in policy terms entirely out of sync with the current administration, and they don't have the standing or the authority to talk about policy
There's
any
also
longer.
This hysteria over the Voice of America thing, which is...
Can you go into explain that?
Sure. The Voice of America was founded to be the voice of America abroad. And part of its mission, its initial mission, was that it was prohibited from broadcasting in the United States. Well, no longer. In the Obama years, there was a law that was passed and signed into law by the president, which allows the Voice of America to broadcast into the United States. Donald Trump has sent liaisons to the Voice of America, sending the left into fits of panic and terror over the prospect of a government-run propaganda outlet broadcasting inside the United States, broadcasting Trumpian propaganda.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is an interesting thing I happen to know quite a lot about because I had a brother-in-law who was the chief editorialist of the Voice of America, no longer my brother-in-law and no longer the chief editorialist of the Voice of America. But this happened actually in the wake of the Vietnam War and revelations in the late 60s and early 70s that the Voice of America and no information from the Voice of America could legally be promulgated in the United States. I say that my brother-in-law was writing editorials. I was not legally allowed to read or hear these editorials inside the United States for fear that it would be government propagandizing Americans. This seems to be a little crazy. Like, Voice of America had these famous jazz show, like, the among other things, broadcast was the probably, I'm told, the greatest jazz broadcasting service in the world.
We use the Voice of America. I was broadcasting about, you know, a few blocks down at WABC. We used the Voice of America clips all the time,
right?
Because it was accessible on the internet.
Right. Well, that's why the rule was changed. The rule was changed because it makes no sense anymore. There is no such thing as a blocking of anything's broad, because anything that you can hear, you know, in Tajikistan, you can hear over the internet in the United States. That's why they lifted the law.
They weren't like propagandistic news clips.
Right.
They were news.
Right. Yeah. Also, basically, the funny part about that is that according to people who knew, you know, it's not like the Voice of America was all that pro-American sometimes. And, you know, but it has all these services, many services in many different languages, you know, in an effort to communicate abroad. I think the other nervousness about the Voice of America is that, you know, is that there are services that attempt to provide news information, you know, to people in, you know, in the Russian ambit. And that Trump's, you know, absurd friendship with Putin may lead to a crackdown on efforts to make sure that people in, you know, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, in Chechnya, you know, and inside Russia have some access to independent information that isn't being, you know, stymied by the Russian government, and that maybe something will happen there, which should be worrying. If we're going to have the Voice of America, it should be there to help communicate the truth to people who live, you know, with less freedom than others.
Well, there's also Radio Free Liberty Radio, Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty, which performs the same service.
Right. Radio Free Europe basically doesn't really have a purpose anymore because it was designed to broadcast behind the Iron Curtain, and there is no Iron Curtain. So it's a, you know, that's a slightly separate matter, because the Voice of America, the controversies now involve, like, is China, you know, China blocking it. There were big controversies in the 1980s about something that was created called Radio Marti in an effort to broadcast to Cuba, which, of course, left-wingers really hated and tried to stop and said it was imperialistic, and they were going to use blimps to do it. It was a whole – anyway, whatever. So that's an interesting twist, right? But so everything is the Trump administration could become a fascist, you know, could bring about fascism in the United States. I want to disagree with one thing that Abe said, that, you know, that it's been like a policy frenzy by the Trump administration. My guess is that what Trump has done in the last week is no different in degree from what Clinton did after Bush in 93, from what Bush did in 2001 after Clinton, and from what Obama did in 2009 after this. That is, reversals of longstanding policies like Obama, like the constant reversal and unreversal of the Mexico City rules governing the use of federal funds to promote abortions abroad, which Democrats like and Republicans kill. And some other things, but the, you know, suspension of all regulations and the if Obama's going to issue executive orders to kill the Keystone Pipeline, then Trump can issue an executive order to restore the Keystone Pipeline. So, you know, live by the executive order, die by the executive order. If you're going to do stuff that Congress doesn't authorize or appropriate for, that is law until it's revoked, then sorry, you know, that's one of the reasons you shouldn't do it. That's one of the reasons executive orders should only exist as they are constitutionally supposed to exist, as means of fulfilling in a more streamlined and effective way the acts of Congress that you have signed into law as president.
Right. No, I mean, he's on a tear equal to the tear Obama was on in terms of executive action.
Well, we've not yet seen executive action. We've seen executive order. The executive action formulation was Obama's way to get around the fact that Congress had made no law authorizing these executive orders. Yeah. So right. He just created sort of from whole cloth this executive action, which implemented law, something quasi-law. Because we can't wait.
Right, which in fact makes what Trump has done less worrisome than those things.
I don't know. I think it makes it more worrisome, in fact, because these things are extra constitutional and I think unconstitutional. And if you have them done by successive presidents, we are now normalizing something that should simply not exist. And in fact, how many of those Obama executive orders where executive actions were overturned by courts? Several. I mean, I think almost all of them were brought up before the courts were overturned, including the famous Dreamers Act thing, which, you know, three courts, I think, at different times and for different reasons got rid of. It's bad. And, you know, that's the horror of the moment, which is, okay, you know, this is why you don't want to open these Pandora's boxes, because Obama does it. And just like the filibuster, just like killing the filibuster, you know, you start making it thinkable and you know, no one is going to take that tool and put it back, you know, in the shed and lock the tool cabinet if they can make use of it. And so now we have a ridiculous extension of executive power.
But the undoing of things isn't, I think, as threatening as the original doing. Right. I mean, because the problem comes with the invention.
Right.
Sort of. Well, it's taking the step to
well, now we should talk about the invention, right? Yeah. Go ahead, Noah.
We're on the precipice now of some executive orders related to immigration, as far as what Donald Trump had campaigned on. Two of them, which stand out, are obviously the expedition of the creation of a physical contiguous barrier along the Mexican border, which is again an executive order because it has the force of law. They're citing a 2006 law that passed the Republican-led Congress and George W. Bush authorizing the creation of this wall. And we can go into some detail
fence.
About
– I mean, the law literally is called the border fence. The law calls it a fence.
Well, it was adapted. I think Kay Bailey Hutchison had something to do with the adaptation, making it no longer contiguous, somewhat non-physical. There are parts of this border are just, you know, vehicle barriers.
Yeah, because a lot of it's in a river. So there's no way you can build a wall in a river. So the idea was you would need surveillance where the river where you couldn't have a wall in the river.
So we're kind of a digression, but we're doing this Mexican wall thing, and the Congress is going to fund it to the tune of $7 to $14 billion, according to Speaker Paul Ryan, and they're going to do so rather deftly through the process of funding the government so that Democrats don't have to vote on a standalone bill to filibuster this wall and make it a political issue. They either shut down the government or fund the wall. And that's kind of clever, even if whether you agree or not with the policy, it's a clever way to go about it, considering what we went through in the Obama years.
By the way, to be fair, the 2006 Border Fence Act was passed by a vote in the Senate of something like 88 to 12. So it's not like it was a, you know, even though, you know, I'm very, you know, I'm a dove where immigration is concerned. This was a totally bipartisan idea.
Border security is popular. It would be a silly thing to filibuster on, except for the fact that the Democratic base, the rabid base of liberals, is very much opposed to just about anything Donald Trump says or does related to immigration. And they have a lot to chew on with the second issue related to executive orders on immigration, which has to do with refugee and visa intakes from a particular part of the world, particularly the Middle East and North Africa. Some very that select would be countries.
Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen are the countries that where there will be an immediate suspension of refugee intake. And these are all
and
people
visas.
And visas. And these are all people who have been vetted, in fact, under, you know, in some cases for 2 years. It's not like they're just, you know, walking in the door. It's not so easy to get in. Very hard to. The refugee thing is a 2-year process, and the visa thing is also an extensive process. So, even so, there's going to be a suspension, but it's only from those countries. So, NOAA, following some sour opinions being expressed, was a little concerned about the missing countries.
There are some conspicuous omissions. If we are talking exclusively about the overabundance of caution in the prevention of Islamist terrorism and the infiltration of the United States by those who wish to execute Islamist terrorist attacks. Notable among those are countries like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Lebanon, and Pakistan. Particularly when it comes to – oh, and by the way, just a discretion, Europe isn't on that list. And just about half the terrorist attacks, particularly the one in Paris, in Bataclan, which prompted the Muslim terrorist ban, that was executed by primarily people who are French natives. So we have the indigenous terrorist problem of Europe is something that is not being addressed here. But that's also just kind of a digressionary rhetorical point. Especially when it comes to places like Saudi Arabia, which experienced a variety of simultaneous terrorist attacks in July in places like Medina, and in Egypt, where you have a robust terrorist element that operates rather aggressively in the Sinai Peninsula, and in Pakistan, which is where the wife of the San Bernardino shooter, Tashfeen Malik, who emigrated to Saudi Arabia and then was introduced into the United States as sort of a mail-order bride. She was a Pakistani native and a naturalized Saudi citizen, and these people are just not on the list.
Okay, so what this suggests to me is that there has been a maturation in the Trump world in relation to the incredibly irresponsible and wild ideas expressed in the, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the San Bernardino shootings, that there should be a complete halt of all Muslim travel to the United States, including by citizens who were abroad, until we can find out what the hell is going on, and a suspension of all visas and all that. And so here you have an effort at a certain type of selectivity. You take these countries that are, you know, incredibly weak states in which it's very hard to vet, and they're, you know, awash in civil war and ISIS and, you know, immediate terrorism, Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. And so somebody says, well, wait a minute, we can't do this with, Pakistan. It's too complicated. Like, granted, Pakistan's like a bad, you know, the bad actors, a lot of bad things going on there. But, you know, this, you know, we're going to get ourselves into a gigantic, we're trying to, we have this asset there, we have that asset there, we can't do that, and we can't do it in Egypt because it'll make President Sisi look bad, and we like President Sisi, and we can't do it in Saudi Arabia because we have, you know, there are 25,000 Americans, there are 40,000 Americans who are working in Saudi Arabia, and what's going to happen to them? And so, even though a lot of people are on the left are now saying, aha, this is a big emoluments issue because Trump has business in these places, nonetheless, it's like, okay, so they're a little, you know, it's a ridiculous policy, but let us, you know, let us at least, you know, make it conform with some evident part of reality. What strikes me as most interesting, I think Abe is most interesting, is something that Trump said about what would happen with the suspension of any Syrian entry into the United States. What did Trump say during his statement yesterday?
That so during this period, he's going to have people look at and draw up new sort of vetting criteria on a country by country.
Yeah, but also that he would establish safe zones.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So he would establish safe zones for Syrian refugees.
Inside Syria.
Okay, so
inside and around, he said.
Okay, establishing safe zones in and around Syria involves the deployment of substantial numbers of American troops on the ground.
John Kerry's State Department estimated 30,000 U.S. troops would be needed to secure that – that location, right. which we paid for by the Gulf states, by the way.
Right. So he just said it.
And that's secure. That's hold and maintain. That's not secure from the air and the ground with an invasion force.
Yeah. So I'm just saying, like, so with a wave of his hand or a flip of his tongue or whatever you want to talk about it, suddenly Donald Trump is an interventionist in the Syrian civil war.
That's right.
With the commission of a larger deployment of America. You know, right now we got 5,000 troops in.
Almost 7,000.
7,000 troops in Iraq, and we have, I don't know, we have still in 18,000, I think, in Afghanistan, something like that. So that's this would be the largest deployment, new deployment of Americans, you know, since the Georgetown.
This is something since he said in the campaign, and it didn't get any discussion.
Absolutely
then. He said we would establish safe zones at presumably in the north of the Syrian north, and now that it has Russia's imprimatur, Russia said, you know, we could look into this. We kind of welcome it, which presumably means that it would be located along the northern border with Turkey, which I'm not sure how Turkey would react to that, but all they care about are the Kurds.
Wait, is that what you got from the Russian response?
That's what I got from it. Yeah, because initially when we were talking about this in the Obama administration. They were talking about a southern safe zone and a northern safe zone. And nobody's talking about the southern safe zone anymore along the Lebanese border because that's Hezbollah. So we're talking about the northern border with Turkey. And he said it in debates.
Well,
he said it on physical debates that
there's
we were
also the
have.
Eastern border with ISIS and Iraq.
That's its own problem.
Yeah. But anyway, the point is, so can we trust that any of that? I mean, really? Trump?
That's why nobody talked about it, because nobody believes he means it.
Really? Trump is going to establish a safe zone?
Yeah,
I mean, he's going to send 30,000 guys into the most dangerous area in the world?
According to Reuters, he's asking the Pentagon and the State Department to draw up these plans.
Okay, well you know, if that happens.
Gonna consist of, they're going to say, we're going to incur 10,000 casualties.
Well, if that happens, Never Trumper Max Boot, contributor commentary, is going to have to start. Reconsidering his tunes.
But I mean, and also, and for the record, Trump is way out ahead of this. I mean, he says absolutely. That's his direct line on. He says he will absolutely establish safe zones for Syrians.
Initially, Hillary Clinton had supported something similar and backed off and only supported a no-fly zone.
She backed off because of Bernie Sanders. She could have stayed with it.
That was unfeasible because it would have required confrontation with Moscow. We no longer have that worry. Moscow's on board.
Right. Supposedly.
Yeah, by the way, I didn't get that from the Moscow statement, but I could have been misreading it.
What did Moscow's on board?
Yeah, I thought they were sort of saying, I think the U.S. should sort of look into this, meaning consider all the consequences here. That was what I sort of took.
I just thought it was a very interesting thing that Trump, and I'm not sure I understand it, to be honest, that Trump is saying, okay, I'm suspending Syrian, there could be 110,000, supposedly we're going to be taking 110,000 Syrians in the next 2 years. So he has, A, cut that number arbitrarily to 50,000, and it's suspended now for 120 days, or until such time as he decides that it should be unsuspended. It is striking to me that he should then add safe zones to this, because I thought it was America gets itself involved too much, and it does too much, and you know this isn't our problem, and you know we got to make America great again. And yet there's some weird thing going on where he can't just say, you know, the hell with them, you know, the hell with them, you know, let them kill each other, which is fundamentally something that basically Obama said without saying it.
Well, you said earlier that you believe that there had been some maturation inside the Trump camp, and this would reflect a maturity of thinking in the form of the fact that he's saying we need to stop this refugee thing. The refugee thing is an existential threat to Western civilization. Therefore, how do you stop it? How do you contain that conflict?
I mean, if Jim Mattis is saying America must do this, you know, because our, you know, everything that we will want for the rest of the century will be predicated on our having done something to stop the genocide in Syria, and Obama's listening to him, that would be pretty striking. I mean, we don't know that. All we know, you know, the only thing we know in policy terms in terms of these guys is Bannon and Breitbart, and certainly deployment of Americans in Syria would not fit with the Bannon-Breitbart view, which would be the hell with them, but you can kill as many terrorists as you want in whatever way you want, and the hell with the Syrians, which you know is not an irrational position in the sense like, well, what's our national interest in Syria? We don't have any national interest in Syria. Let the Russians fix it. We don't have any national interest in Syria. But, you know, as a matter of fact, almost 500,000 people have died. And if we're not going to let them in, another 100,000 of them are going to get killed because they were on the list.
You know, it would be also
having been vetted on the grounds that they had a substantial and sustained fear of either persecution or being killed. I mean, those are the standards by which we vetted refugees in Syria.
It would also be, I think, politically smart in that it would give him some cover on the refugee issue. And it would also allow him to sort of speak differently to Europe about the refugee issue and you know, having influence.
But what kind of appetite is there in the United States or Western Europe for an intervention of this scale in one of the most gruesome conflicts of the last decade?
There isn't. But it's just interesting that his political instincts seem to tell him that he should be saying this and not saying the other. The second most interesting political instinct question is the Democratic enthusiasm for an outright statement of support for the sanctuary city policy, where Trump is saying, you know, we are now going to figure out ways that the federal government will withhold monies for states and localities that harbor, that, you know, have as their explicit policy a policy of non-cooperation with the immigration service in relation to illegal aliens, and that they will, you know, provide all public services and keep in, not allow cops to arrest or hold or do all that sort of thing. There was a huge demonstration in New York last night over this and some other places. And to me, it strikes me that this is insanity. This is insanity. There is a part of the Democratic base that is loves sanctuary cities and thinks it's wonderful and thinks it's great, but you cannot tell me that if you did a poll of Democrats and you said they're illegal aliens and the federal government wants to find them and deport, particularly if they're criminals, and deport them, do you support or oppose your local police force and your local mayor and stuff like that providing services and preventing their deportation? You think Democrats wouldn't in large majority support that idea?
Well, that's what it became. It wasn't initially that. Initially, it was a law enforcement strategy so that you could have sources inside illegal immigrant communities who would speak to police about criminal activity.
Yeah, that's their claim. I know. That was always
– That was initially.
Yeah, it was a lot of crap. That was total crapola. That was what was said when they set up sanctuary cities during periods of high crime. So now it's like – well, they contribute to our economy. So, and I, as I keep saying, like, I'm a dove on immigration, but I think as a political matter, you know, I found it very hard to make the argument when people said, so what are you saying? You don't want to enforce the law? Of course you want to enforce it. It's the American, it's the United States. You enforce the law. You know, it's passed by legislatures and signed by the president. That's how it works. And this notion that states and localities have the right to evade or retard the, you know, Immigration and Naturalization Service is insane. And I'm just saying, like, Democrats as a mass rule, if Democrats have any hope of getting clawing back some of that Obama vote, that, you know, the sort of white working class vote that went to Obama, and getting it back in 2020 if they don't like Trump, you know, becoming the voice and the, you know, having an open and kind of central part of the Democratic Party's identity being its support for illegality is demented. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Maybe this has gone too far and, you know, consciousnesses have changed about this, but I don't think so. What does Trump say? He says, I want to arrest the bad guys and send them back to Mexico. And you're making it impossible. You, Mayor, whatever your name, you, Andrew Cuomo. Andrew Cuomo, the governor of our state, said, if I did, deport me first, he said. It's like, well, you know what? Don't do me. Don't make any offers. You know, that's a very, very attractive offer to me. But, you know, can anyone find a defense for that? Politically, I'm saying. I'm not saying morally or spiritually or whatever.
Yeah, I think they think that they can conflate illegal and legal immigration, and then create this groundswell of gauzy admiration for the ideal of the American immigrant community. And around that, they can catalyze a movement that includes people who are otherwise not liberal Democrats who also agree that immigration is a good thing. Polls suggest that people don't hate immigration.
Yeah, but I think this is a loser, though. I mean, I don't think there's any way that
– Well, I'm saying that's what I think they're thinking. I don't think anybody thinks that illegal immigrants should be given safe harbor, and that's a really great winning strategy. They're not talking about illegal immigrants. None of them are up there saying illegal immigrants. They're saying immigrants.
Well, so here's the interesting thing for us. I think we were all sobered and understood that we had misunderstood a great deal when Trump got the same amount of the Hispanic vote as Romney, right? We assumed that his Hispanic vote would be half Romney's. He would go 14, 15, 16% because, you know, it wasn't just the stuff that he said about immigration, but also the stuff he said about Judge Curiel and various other things, right? So that didn't happen. So what that tells me is not that it's great that the Republicans only get 30% of the Hispanic vote, but what it tells me is that there is a huge misunderstanding of the nature of the Hispanic vote, that it is that while there may be consciousness, specific Hispanic consciousness that drives it to 70-30, nothing's driving it below 30 if Trump didn't drive it below 30. That means people vote – there are 30% of them who are Republican and they vote for the Republican and just like everybody else. You know, that's – and so they're 70-30 and, you know, maybe they could go 65-35 as things goes on, or, you know, 60-40 over time maybe. We thought that Trump was going to, you know, make this – it was going to be like the Jewish vote with Clinton in 1992, Bush and Clinton, when the Jewish vote dropped to 11% after Bush, you know, was so awful toward – the first Bush was so awful toward Israel. And that didn't happen. So they're still operating, it seems to me, Democrats, on the idea that they can really drive Hispanics into their arms. And I think that's nuts. I mean, if nothing is going to make – is going to be worse – than Trump in 2016. No policy that is affected is going to be worse. Nothing is going to be worse. Meanwhile, we have news breaking as we went that the president of Mexico is not going to come to the United States to meet with Trump.
Right.
So that summit isn't going to happen. So our summit's going to be Theresa May and President Trump. First big foreign visit. So we'll talk about that on Monday when we reconvene. And remember, Commentary Magazine is the 72-year-old monthly of opinion, analysis, criticism, and observation from a conservative perspective. Join our conversation at commentarymagazine.com. You get a few free reads, and then we ask you to subscribe. $19.99 for a digital subscription, $29.95 for an all-access subscription. So for Noah Rothman and Abe Greenwald, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.